Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. Coming up in just a bit, we'll speak with one of the organizers of the third annual Eastern Shore FanCon, the ultimate convention here on the shore to geek out on comics, video games, and anime. We'll find out about the growing niche market here on the shore and why this year is poised to be the biggest yet in the event's history. But first, as warm weather starts to show its face in the region, it's crabbing season for the iconic watermen of the Eastern Shore and the Chesapeake Bay. So joining me to talk about the upcoming season and the struggles facing one of the shore's oldest industries is Robert T. Brown. He's the president of the Maryland Watermen's Association. Robert T., welcome to the program, and thanks for being with me.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here to join you today.
The Department of Natural Resources recently denied a request from the Maryland Watermen to have an extension on the oyster season, which of course just ended. DNR stated that the 10 days watermen missed or lost from inclement weather was essentially inconsequential because the season was really strong and there was a very high yield of oysters. What's your take on that decision, and how do you assess how the oyster harvest was this year for Maryland watermen?
Well, I will agree with the department that we had a high yield on oysters this year. It's the best that we've had in a number of years. Also, I do disagree with them not extending it for 10 days, because with the high yield means that there are more oysters on the bottom and available for us to catch, and extending those 10 days would not have hurt the season at all or the product into the bay.
You know, I read something interesting about oyster shells in recent months. And it has something to do with the oyster tax money that you guys pay, this oyster surcharge of sorts. It seemingly, there's sort of a regulation that won't allow Maryland watermen to buy shells from Virginia. Explain that for people. What is this issue, and what is your main, you know, umbrage with this issue?
It's a policy that they have adopted this season. Before, we were always allowed to, our MDOT money, which we get from the Port Authority, for allowing them to giving them a place to put the dredge spoils to the channel that goes into Baltimore so that they can conduct commerce with the big shipping trades. And we get paid so much a cubic yard, and that goes in to help plant shells on bottom to help build the culture up. And we got our oyster tax money, which is like a dollar bushel, and every bushel of oysters that is caught, that goes to the help replenish the bottom. And the surcharge, every waterman, when he buys his oyster license, and before he goes oystering, he has to pay a $300 surcharge. And that goes to help planting oysters and shells on the bottom so that, we're getting to where, you know, we're farming some. You know, if you don't plant the seed into, like if you've got radishes, you're not going to have no radishes. You know, they're not going to replenish themselves.
Right.
So, I mean, it helps build more bottom up. So, I mean, we've been doing this for a number of years with seed oysters we used to get out of the James River. We used to, years ago, get it out of Maryland over next to Smith Island and up in Eastern Bay. But the shell program stopped a number of years ago, and you can't keep taking shell and not putting some back. It was over 400,000 bushels of oysters that were harvested this year. And that 400,000 bushels of oysters means that it's 400,000 bushels of shells we took out of the bay.
Right.
And we wanted to put them back. The state says they need them for the hatchery so that they can put spat on shell, which is a good thing and is needed, like up above the Bay Bridge, over in St. Mary's County, where you're in Wicomico River, and different places, because we're not getting natural recruitment there. But where we're getting natural recruitment down around Smith Island, over in Fishing Bay and Lower Eastern Bay and down off of Point Lookout, we can put shells there. Hatchery seed costs about $36 a bushel, and we can get regular shells and put overboard around $5 a bushel. And, I mean, Mother Nature is being generous to us down there now, and it's time for us to take advantage of it. And they say they need all the shells for the hatchery. Well, but and I understand the hatchery and they need it, but what they're doing, they're putting so much stuff into these oyster sanctuaries. What they did was, this past year, they put $31 million into Harris Creek trying to make these big reefs and stuff in there. If our bottom that we're working on now does not produce shell at all because we're not getting enough strike because we don't have enough culture on the bottom, Well, the 400,000 bushels of shells that the state's trying to gobble up for all these private projects we got is not going to be available.
You know, let's talk a little bit about a recent trend that I've seen just in going out and talking to watermen all across the shore. And it seems that, you know, in the oyster fishery and in that trade, there seems to be a move towards aquaculture rather than, you know, wild oyster harvesting that we've seen in the past. I know this area is one of the last places in the country and maybe even on Earth that's doing wild oyster harvesting. Why do you think that there is this move towards aquaculture rather than wild oyster farming?
What people don't understand is the bay is a vast body of water, and it is so enormous that there is room for both in there. The public oyster, the wild oyster, takes over during the wintertime, and this keeps the watermen in their livelihood. And during the summertime, instead of crabbing and stuff, they can turn around and they can start doing this aquaculture, which will put oysters onto the market too. And what that does, when you take a man who is crabbing and take him out of the crabbing business and put him into aquaculture and he oysters during the summer and the winter, what that does, that takes pressure off the crabs. And we need both of them to make the system work.
You know, there's so much of a trend right now going towards locally produced food. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about things that are harvested locally. And is the crab cake or the oyster that's on your plate actually from the region that you're living in? And certainly people that come here on tourist visits, you know, they want to know that, you know, this is a Chesapeake Bay crab or this is a Chesapeake Bay oyster. As you look at the biggest challenges facing the industry right now, we always hear about the regulations, but isn't a rise in competition globally and even at different parts throughout our own country, isn't that just as problematic for the Maryland watermen?
The restaurants and stuff will buy from the local people when it's available. However, you got to realize, especially with the crab, the crab industry, most of the crabs that you eat in restaurant, the male crabs, a lot of them come from Maryland, but we do have some, like, especially this time of year when they get ready to start, they'll be coming out of Louisiana, they'll mm-hmm. be coming out of Georgia. The crab meat and a crab cake, we've got a few pick houses here in Maryland who do a lot of crab meat. When it's available, the crabs are available for them to pick. Now, when it's not available for them to pick, the restaurants would either have to take them off the menu if they were going to have Maryland crab only, or they would get Maryland from a crab meat from a different state other than Maryland. You could get it from Virginia. You could get it from Georgia, North Carolina. There's a lot of crab meat that comes from out of the country, Venezuela, over in Vietnam. And a lot of the, if the restaurants were to put specifically on it, this is Maryland crab meat, they would have to have two or three menus, because you would have to say exactly where it came from. It's a restaurant doing its business to have seafood on it, and sometimes you can't get it exactly where you want it from.
Now, with that all that being said, how does crabbing season look right now as you're in the early stages of it? How are things looking for this season?
Well, Mother Nature hasn't been very kind to us this winter. We've had a load of snow, and it's been cold so long. Crabbing season in Maryland started April the 1st. There is almost nobody crabbing now in the state of Maryland because the water temperature is just around 40 degrees. And the crabs, they bury during the wintertime, and they hibernate. And they won't come out and start moving around until this water temperature gets up around 52 degrees. We don't know what we've got yet because a lot of the crabs are still buried and they haven't came out of the mud and haven't moved yet. Water temperature is what controls all of that.
Is this something, as far as water temperature goes, where you kind of lose the first week or two waiting for water temperature to increase?
I've seen it where it has been very slow the first couple of weeks because the water temperature is cool. But I was talking to a man who's been crabbing all his life, and this is the first year in 40 years that he's got his pots and oil ready to go, and he is not crabbing because the water temperature is too cold. And with the price of fuel and the price of bait, and he knows that he's not going to catch anything. I mean, he does it. He knows what the temperature's got to be before the crabs will start to move.
Do you think now that the temperatures are starting to warm that this will catch up and things, you know, including water temperature, will right-size itself and the crabbing season will be salvageable?
Well, yeah. It's not going to hold it up that much. It's going to hold it up 2 to 3 weeks because, you know, you get a nice warm day and it feels nice out and you got you finally shedded your jacket's off and you're down to a shirt and it feels nice. But you got to realize the Chesapeake Bay's got 100 and some feet of water into it in a lot of places, and it's like 12, 15 miles wide in a lot of places. And it takes a long time to warm up that amount of water.
We've been speaking to Robert T. Brown. He's the president of the Maryland Watermen's Association. Robert T., always good to talk to you, and best of luck this crabbing season.
Oh, and thank you, and the best of luck to you, too.
All it'll take is just one moment, and you can say goodbye to how we have.
Up next, the third annual Eastern Shore FanCon is happening this weekend at UMES in Princess Anne, Maryland. And for fans of anime, video games, and comic books here on the shore, the event is like a weekend trip to Graceland, if you will. But as James Duvendock, who heads up marketing for both FanCon and the award-winning Eastern Shore-based PLB Comics, explains, the demand for a niche event like this on the shore has seemingly exploded in recent years.
We really didn't know what to expect. Again, you're right, you know, it's an area that hadn't had something of this size before, that hadn't had something of this scope before. And we all kind of waited it with bated breath as the doors opened. And when there was a line, I think we all sighed a little with relief. And that first year, you know, people were very happy with it. We ended up with an attendance around 450, maybe a little better. Vendors were very happy. Artists were very happy. And at the end of the day, I heard nothing but positive response. And that just proved to me that this area was hungry for something like this, where everyone down here who likes anime, who likes comic books, who likes video games, who likes geeky stuff, they're tired of driving 3 hours.
So after the success of year one, tell me about what you did in year two and what you're doing in year three to piggyback on the success of the demand that's here.
I expect, and honestly, this is being a little conservative, I expect 1,000 people this year. I think we found a niche that was underserved, and we're definitely expanding on it. What I found from last year is that people who aren't necessarily really very into this stuff, they came anyway, just because it's something interesting and new and different here on the shore. And we've built up our certain areas that weren't really there the first year. Cosplay or costuming is a big, you know, addition. We saw that area of the convention grow hugely over from the first year to the second, where the first year, you know, we had a few people in. It was a good showing. It was very respectable. The second year, I had to send somebody out to get me more copies of the entry form. It was at that level. This year, we've actually moved that whole situation over into the big theater at UMES because we're going to need it. Yeah. We have started to do more things for kids. This year, in fact, we have a kids' corner where there'll be some crafts and coloring and things just focused directly at children, and that'll be free with admission. And it's something we hadn't had in the previous 2 years, and something I think, you know, will be enjoyed, and something that people had asked for. And we listened and we gave it to them. Yeah. We're also going to go ahead and do more gaming, not video gaming, but tabletop gaming. Our local store, Phoenix Rising, Games and Comics in Salisbury, they're actually sponsoring a tabletop gaming room, and we are an official international tabletop gaming day event. We'll also be doing a Yu-Gi-Oh! Tournament and other things. And these are just things that as we're going, we see a demand for, people have asked for, and we're more than willing to give. You know, we're more than willing to say, sure, that's a great idea. Let's go ahead and do that.
Right. Tell me a little bit about what people are getting out of this. Not only the fans, but also the vendors. People like, you know, you guys. I mean, months ago we met PLB Comics and learned about your art and making these books and sometimes how making these books aren't exactly the most profitable things. But it's art.
Well, I think that's actually a similar answer between the two. You know, you got to understand that the vendors and the artists and everything else, they're fans too. So they love to do these things as well. You know, no one goes into this going, oh man, I got to do another show. You know, everybody goes into this saying, wow, this is going to be fun. You know, that just like an attendee. I think what the vendors got, and I'll answer that first, is they found a segment of customers in the attendees that didn't have to pay $50 to walk in, that didn't have to pay for parking, that didn't have to drive 3 hours, that didn't have to get a hotel room. And suddenly these people have money. because they haven't spent out on all those other things. And so, you know, people were hungry. People wanted this content. And when it was delivered to them, they were eating it up. And that's something that I kind of did foresee. I knew that was going to happen, you know, that there was going to be a certain amount of that. Again, it's with the bigger conventions, and I love the bigger conventions, you pay a lot more to be there. And that goes for attendees and vendors. And you have to take that into consideration. There's only so much room in the wallet. So when this happens, people can kind of be freer. It gives vendors, with smaller shows like ours, it gives vendors and artists and other people a chance to really talk to the consumers of their product, the fans of their art, and build those relationships that will continue to, you know, blossom forth from there. And we at PLB Comics have certainly found that with smaller shows, with independent shows, that we have the time, we have, you know, the inclination to really sit down with people, to really talk to people, to explain what we do, you know, to laugh and joke and build those relationships that will really last a long time. As far as attendees, I think we pack an awful lot of bang for the buck at this show. I mean, $10 admission, $8 if you're in costume, and we provide anime screenings all day, also in a actual movie theater, not just in a little screening room. You can't even go see a movie for that much, you know, much less get all the other stuff. Plus, there's video games. We do video game free play, where there's just systems set up from Atari up, just whatever you like, and you can sit down and play this thing. And I mean, take $10 to an arcade, see how far it gets you.
Right. Well, it's interesting because the niche, and niche was a word that you mentioned earlier, and you know, if you look nationwide, the enthusiasm or the rabid excitement, if you will, for comics or anime or video games is sort of oftentimes pigeonholed into a certain age demographic, whether it be young kids or whether it be 18 to 34. Are you seeing that demographic, that those three genres, comics, anime, and video games are often pigeonholed into, do you see that growing on the fringes at all? I mean, is this something that continues to grow sort of out of a niche, and maybe is it pushing mainstream?
I think so. I think what was, you know, what got us locked in, you know, shoved in our lockers in high school, not really. What was seen as kind of nerdy, what was seen as kind of geeky when we were kids, that's expanded. I mean, what's one of the highest rated television shows right now? It's The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead's a comic book. That's where it comes from. I mean, it's a TV show now, and sure, that's where all the money is, but it started from a comic book. What are the top grossing movies in the U.S. for the past decade, practically? They're comic book movies every single time. Anime, I mean, there was a time when the only way to get anime was you had to go to these little kind of trader conventions and you would get dubbed VHS tapes, you know, and that's how you got your anime. Well, now you can walk into any retailer of DVDs and you're going to find anime in there. That was not always the case. I think we're seeing this stuff hit the mainstream. Video games, I mean, that's a market that is huge. And that wasn't always the case. I think we are seeing this hit mainstream. And I think as far as age brackets, yeah, the age brackets you had suggested are pretty much, you know, the major buyers, but that's not the only ones. We see all age groups at shows like this. We see people who you would not expect to show up to these things show up and have a fantastic time.
That was James Doofendock of the award-winning PLB Comics and the Eastern Shore Fan Con, which will be happening this weekend at UMES in Princess Anne, Maryland. You're listening to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Marceau.